swim by. When I got down to the river, so lonesome I wanted to die, oh Lord. But when I jumped in the river, the doggone river was dry.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Lloyd Carter. You're listening to Down in the Valley. The monthly show airs on the second Friday of each month. We look at water, air quality issues in the old San Joaquin Valley. And I'm very happy to say we have a guest today, and I hope we're going to have a real interesting discussion. Susanna DeAnda. Susanna, are you there?
Good, yes, I'm here.
Susanna is from the Community Water Center in Visalia, and she's fighting for clean drinking water for people in the South Valley. We have a lot of activity going up in Sacramento where they want to build multi-billion dollar dams, and Susanna worries about first things first, which is we need to deliver clean drinking water to people. Susanna, why don't you tell me a little bit first about the Community Water Center and then what you're involved in?
Yeah, so Community Water Center is an environmental justice organization based here in Visalia. We seek to ensure that all communities have access to safe, clean, and affordable drinking water. We work on the principle that clean drinking water is a basic human right, and that should not be a privilege. So we're based here in the Valley. We work for and from the Valley to try to achieve water justice.
Okay, give me a little snapshot now of what drinking water conditions are in the San Joaquin Valley, and particularly in the southern half of the Valley.
Most definitely. So one thing first, over 90% of the communities in the Valley rely on the state's most polluted groundwater as a source of drinking water. That in turn says that what we see is that in Tulare County alone, we have over 20% of all the small community public drinking systems are unable to meet basic water drinking requirements. Also, 75% of all the private wells here in Tulare County alone tested by the state have contamination over the legal limits. This means that communities are paying twice for water. They're paying for a water bill that they cannot use to drink, and on top of that, they're having to drive to buy bottled water or fill up those water gallon jugs.
Okay, now, as you are well aware, a week from today is the deadline for this effort to get a $9.3 billion water bond measure on the November ballot. Governor Schwarzenegger and Senator Dianne Feinstein are pushing this along with the California Farm Bureau Federation and Southern California development interests. And as you know, we've had caravans of agribusiness folks and farm workers going to Sacramento to rally for this bond measure. What do you see as the flaw in that bond measure?
Well, we see a lot of flaws in the measure. We believe that this is a wasteful water bond that is not addressing all of California's water needs, particularly the drinking water need we're having here in the Central Valley. We believe that California cannot continue to pass water bonds that supply temporary band-aids to some communities while leaving others without safe drinking water. We believe this bond is ineffective, and we want the governor not to put it on the November ballot and urge him to think more about true water management policies and true programs that really will ensure that all Californians, particularly the ones here in the Central Valley, secure safe drinking water. It is unfair that the governor now has called this a state of emergency when, for us, the reality has been that we have been in an emergency. For decades, Central Valley communities have been unable to drink water out of their tap because of over high levels of contamination.
Now, did I understand you to say that some of you are planning a trip to Sacramento next week to lobby?
What we're going to do, Community Water Center, with Central Valley communities and farm workers, are going to actually be part of a four-series press conference to join our voice as a statewide and urge the governor not to put the bond on the November ballot. Visalia will be one of the four press conferences to send the message to the governor that, yes, farm workers, yes, we do need jobs, but we also need safe water to drink. So we cannot compromise one or the other. We need both to survive.
Now, as you are well aware, there has the Fresno Mayor Alan Autry, among others, has all of a sudden expressed a great deal of concern for our farm workers on the west side of the valley because of the cutback in water deliveries, in particular to the Westlands Water District. Apparently, the United Farm Workers, obviously they're concerned about jobs. Do you feel that the farm workers are being used or manipulated by the big growers in some cases?
Well, you know, I think our community partners on the ground, we need to be educated that this bond only serves one issue. And for that side of the valley, I think we need to understand that we have to manage our resources more appropriately and stop farming in areas where it's not sustainable, because that in turn displaces families. So I think our farm workers need to know the bigger picture, that we need to send a message to the governor that we need jobs, but we also need safe drinking water to survive. And I think our campesinos, we just need to be well aware that the issue is broader than just jobs. We can't compromise one or the other. And ultimately, how is this bond going to get paid back? How it gets paid back is using general funds and cutting back our services that we rely on. So it's either, okay, do you want safe drinking water, or do you want me to cut your health services? And that's, we say no to that. We lose both ways. So I think both our farm worker communities need to understand that when we lobby in Sacramento on this bond, we also have to tell the governor that we need safe drinking water along with jobs.
Now, let me ask you, Susanna, what is the number one pollutant in drinking water supplies in the South Valley in particular? Some of the other problem pollutants, and then after you've discussed those, I want to talk to you about why our county health officials or our regional water board or our state department of health, why aren't they going after these degraded water supplies? But first talk about what the primary problems in the drinking water are, the main pollutants.
Yeah, so the main pollutant in our drinking water has been nitrates. Nitrates by far have been the contaminant that has caused a lot of the wells throughout the state to close down. Nitrates are coming from a variety of sources, from dairy manure, fertilizer, and septic tanks. But by far, nitrates have been the biggest cause of well closure throughout the state, and it's also the contaminant that we see in a lot of the systems that are unable to provide safe drinking water. And nitrates, so you all know, it's linked to the blue baby syndrome. So that means a baby, if they ingest a nitrate-contaminated water, the blood is unable to absorb oxygen, so the baby literally turns blue. Nitrates are also connected to kidney disease and other diseases as well, so it's a big concern. And if you don't know that it's in the water, you can't taste it or smell it, but you need to check for it, and that for sure is the biggest problem that we see in the valley in terms of contamination.
Now, these local water districts that are serving this tainted drinking water to people, what's the regulatory authority that, and why aren't they being required to bring this drinking water up to standards?
Well, local water boards, depending on the kind of structure they are, there's different guidelines that they have to follow. Ultimately, what we're seeing is that, for years, unregulated agriculture has pretty much had the free ticket to pollute. And now we're seeing the consequence that our communities are having to pay the price through their health because the system's not able to provide safe drinking water. We're talking about systems that are about, either 100 hookups or more, more or less. And it's really hard for a system to provide, to have the operation maintenance sustainable, to get money and grant monies to do treatment for the system. In reality, on the ground, what we need is better regulation to the polluting entities. And at the end of the day, Community Water Center and our community partners, we're not against the industry. We're against the lack of regulation and their continued contamination. And we need to put an end to that. And bringing it back to the bond discussion, I think, the governor has called this a state of emergency. We have been in a state of emergency for years now. Our Central Valley communities are unable to drink their water out of their tap. And they're forced to buy bottled water. So this is an issue of, it's not that you want to buy bottled water. People are having to buy bottled water as a source of drinking water.
It seems ironic that in many cases the farmers themselves have domestic wells on their farms, and they and their own families are also being subjected to this degraded water supply, are they not?
But Most definitely. The difference is that some, you know, economic of scale, some can afford to buy fancier treatments for your house and continue to buy bottled water. But bottled water is not the solution to the drinking water crisis here in California.
Now, when migrant farmers who follow the crops come into the valley, the places where they stay and sleep at night and stuff before they move on, are there labor camps that provide housing? And what is the water source for your typical labor camp?
Well, there's one here in Tulare County that it's a labor camp, Rodriguez Labor Camp. And currently, the system is owned by a private owner. The system exceeds levels of contamination for nitrate. I think they're well above the 45 maximum contaminant level. We're looking at 130 parts per milligram of nitrates. And there, what has happened is the private owner has pretty much said to the residents, don't drink the water, but has given no indication of why. So what has happened is people don't drink the water, but after an in-depth conversation, you come to find out that people are actually using the water for cooking, or they're have a confusion that if they just boil the water, they're able to drink it. But in this situation, if you have nitrates in your water and you boil the water, it only increases the concentration of the contamination.
Now, Susanna, are you familiar with any local or state health studies in which they've documented that pregnant women or newborn babies actually have elevated levels of nitrates or nitrites in their bodies?
You know, I'm not familiar with any of those studies, and I would like to know if anybody out there has them. I would like to read those.
But you do know for a fact that it's been documented in the water supplies.
Yes, yes.
Okay, you're listening to Lloyd Carter. This is Down in the Valley. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Down in the Valley on KFSCLP 94.1 FM in Visalia, California.
We're back. This is Lloyd Carter. You're listening to Down in the Valley. We're talking with Susanna DeAnda, who of the Community Water Center in Visalia, about drinking water pollution problems in many communities in the San Joaquin Valley, and I understand we have a caller on the line. Are you there, caller?
Yes, sir. This is Fritz from Clovis. I had a question and a follow-up question, please.
Go ahead.
Actually, it's a statement. Mr. Carter, you made a statement that the farmers drink the contaminated water. Don't all the farmers live over there on Van Ness Extensions?
Well, yeah. Actually, I was referring to farmers on the east side of the valley. And if you'll notice, the residential patterns in the farming communities on the east side are vastly different on the west side, of course, where many of the farmers do not live on their land and they live in Fresno. But I was referring to east side farmers, and a lot of the nitrate problems, correct me, Susanna, if I'm wrong on this, are more focused on the east side of the valley.
Well, you know, I think they're kind of widespread. I mean, some studies indicate they're more on the east side. That's because we just have some gap in our data, but I think they're most of them are on the east side, yes, but I'm beginning to think that they're probably more widespread.
Well, wherever you intensive use of nitrogen-based fertilizers, mm-hmm. of course, is one of the big problems. And Fritz, you said you had a follow-up question?
Yes, I was listening to one of the local radio shows the other day, and I heard the mayor of Fresno talking about he would entertain a sales tax an income tax increase for this bond thing they're talking about. And I just wondered if you had a comment on that regarding a bond and a tax. I don't really understand that. And I'll take your answer on the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Off the air. What he's referring to, listeners, is that Fresno Mayor Alan Autry has taken a great interest in securing additional water supplies for the Westlands Water District in Fresno County. The Westlands this year is operating at only about 40% of their actual contract allotment of water because of the drought conditions and the problems with the fishery in the Delta. And the mayor has also expressed great concern for farm worker families, which is laudable that he should do so. At one point, he suggested that if the Westlands didn't get their water supplies, he was going to quit paying his taxes, and that he urged people, citizens not involved in the Westlands controversy, to also not pay their taxes. He later rolled back on that. And on the radio show, the Ray Appleton show, earlier this week, somebody asked him if he would support increasing taxes in order to finance this $9.3 billion bond. And he hemmed and hawed quite a bit, but ultimately he admitted that he was supporting raising taxes, which you don't hear Republicans do very often, but in this case, he thought it was important enough. Now, Susanna, I think from your perspective, spending billions of dollars, much of this, of course, is for infrastructure to transfer more Northern California water into the Western San Joaquin Valley and Southern California, which promotes more growth, et cetera, et cetera. And the concern is that part of that $9.3 billion would be for two multi-billion dollar dams, one on the San Joaquin River and one in the Sacramento Valley. Both of these are estimated to cost between $2 and $4 billion each. I think Susanna's concern is before we deliver more water, let's stop polluting the water that we use now, particularly drinking water. And Susanna, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe I read that the California Department of Health Services has estimated that 1 million people in California do not have access to drinking water that meets all of the safety standards.
That is correct, yes.
And it sounds like Africa or some impoverished nation in another part of the world, but in fact right here in California. And of course, the bulk of those people, I presume, live in the San Joaquin Valley.
That is correct. That is correct. And also, according to a lot of the applications submitted by environmental justice communities, there's about $1 billion in need just to meet safe drinking water standards, and another $1 billion in need for wastewater infrastructure that we're not even addressing. And this bond completely ignores this issue. That is why, for us, we believe that it's just it's another debt that Californians would pay, and it's leaving some thirsty.
Yeah, and many folks seem to forget that just 2 years ago, we passed another $10 billion water bond measure, much of that which is unspent. I understand we have another caller. Go ahead.
I called in just to make maybe a couple of comments or points of...
Sure.
It's never going to happen. We can get wrapped up in the bureaucracy and the system and the methods, and I think that's what they want us to do. There's methods to clean our water. Like if we just focus on we need clean water first, I think the natives here showed the Spaniards how to build a box 10 by 10, filled it with different kinds of ceramic earthenware and stoneware, and made a filter, aggregate filter that filter out everything. And I know they still use ceramic today. That's like the best it gets. So if we can take some of these things back and put them into our own hands and not wait to go through the motions like they want us to go through the motions, because that never gets anywhere, that's the only way we're going to accomplish anything, I think.
Well, I agree with your comments, caller. And, of course, many people, the public, rich or poor, we all have an instinctive mistrust of public water agencies delivering us clean water, which is why bottled water in California is a multi-billion dollar business now, because the public mistrusts public drinking water supplies. Unfortunately, that burden falls much harder on poor people than it does on wealthy people who buy bottled water. It also creates great environmental problems.
I see poor people at the when we go and get bottled water, and I would consider us poor under $5,000 a year. You know, it's like it's all poor people south of the border. Families, for the most part, are smart enough to drink the bottled water. It seems like the people of higher classes or supposed higher classes are too busy drinking drinks that they've got, that if they got the water in them, or they can afford all the different things. Like we try to get organic, you know, with all the food stamps they give us. But it's more like they're running us around with our tails because we're not the ones involved in cleaning our own water or making these things happen on, you know, small isolated areas spreading, like where there's groups of communities that live, people that live by each other. You know, it wouldn't be that much money to set up little boxes of crushed ceramics gone from the finest or the largest to the finest or finest to largest. Yeah.
Right. Well,
at the bottom.
Asking the average citizen to engage in that, of course, a lot of people, if they can afford it, they buy filters to put on their water that comes out on the tap in their home. But the problem is that the regulatory agencies, as Susanna has said, are operating a water system which is, in my perspective, irrational. For example, the Delta, which forms a partial drinking water source for 23 million people in California, we allow industries, we allow municipalities and agribusiness to all dump their wastewater into the Delta. And we've learned just in the last few months that ammonia, which is a constituent of urine, is in large amounts in the Delta, and it's not even regulated. Susanna, do you have anything to add to this?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, that despite the title for the water bond, Safe, Clean, Reliable Drinking Water Act of 2008, to us, it just shows that California wants to continue business as usual, while not addressing the real root crisis of drinking water issues in California. So I think we need to be educated on exactly what it is and what he wants to accomplish. And again, to urge the governor not to put this bond on the ballot, and urge him for more of a reform water policies and programs to really ensure that all Californians have access to safe drinking water.
Susanna, for our listeners who have access to the internet, why don't you give your website and also give your street address of your center and perhaps the phone number so people could call for more information?
Definitely. Our website is www.communitywatercenter.org. Our phone number is 559-733-0219, and we're located on 311 West Murray Avenue in Visalia.
And if you would like to repeat that information in Spanish in about a minute, please do so.
All right. Nuestro centro está ubicado en la calle 311 West Murray Avenue. Reúnanse en la convocatoria con la prensa este martes a las 10 de la mañana para decirle al gobernador que no queremos este bond porque no nos ayuda con nuestra crisis del agua potable aquí en el Valle Central. El teléfono es 559-733-0219.
Thank you. And for folks who are interested, because I realize of all people that water is a highly complicated subject, and most people, as long as the water is coming out of the tap and it's not brown, they don't get very fired up about water issues. It's difficult to get the public, even to attend public meetings. Of course, in Susanna's case, she's got communities where the water is coming out of the tap brown. So you see some grassroots organizing. There is another, there's a group called Environmental Justice Coalition for Water. They have a website, ejwatercoalition.org, where you can get, they put out a report in 2005 called Thirsty for Justice.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they point out is that water delivery in this state is controlled by very powerful interests. Agriculture obviously gets 80% of the river water in California, but big cities, metropolitan water district, they control the water. And what happens is the small communities, particularly in the poor and rural areas, just get, quite frankly, shortchanged. Susanna, what is the best thing that you can recommend to people who have concerns about the quality of their own drinking water, or what they can do to get politically involved and activated?
Definitely. What I want to say that it's very evident that California has a clear and consistent policy that we must all change. Water flows towards money and power. Now, I think as individuals, we need to get knowledgeable of our own drinking water. And the way you do that is very easy. If you pay a water bill, call the number on your water bill and demand that you get water analysis reports. You need to be informed about your drinking water. Because as you said, you know, nitrates don't have a flavor or a color. You can't smell them either. You have to test for them. So don't wait until your water comes out brown to find out what's in your water. Because actually, if it comes out brown, it might be safer to drink if it does, versus coming out clear. So I think as individual people listening, it is to your best advantage to call the number on your water bill and ask for those monitoring reports. Now, if you're a private well owner, it is your responsibility to monitor your well and do analysis of your drinking water. So I think those two things are really important for all of us to be knowledgeable about our water.
Does it do any good for a citizen to call the Regional Water Board?
Most definitely. I think the Regional Water Boards are set up because they're agencies that are mandated to protect both our surface water and our groundwater from contamination. So it doesn't hurt to join the voice in calling the Regional Water Board. We as a center are working on a campaign to educate and reform the Regional Water Board in this area for them to really do their job appropriately.
You've been listening to Lloyd Carter. I've been speaking with Susanna DeAnda. Susanna, you got your degree in environmental studies and geography from UC Santa Barbara. You worked at the Santa Barbara County Water Agency. You were the pollution prevention coordinator, community hazardous waste center, et cetera, et cetera. You're a long way from Santa Barbara now, aren't you?
That is right.
You're down in the trenches and on the front lines. Well, we hope that people will continue to educate themselves. CommunityWaterCenter.org is Susanna's website. My website is LloydGCarter.com. There's lots of useful information out there if you want to educate yourselves and get energized, because literally public health is at stake. And I personally think it's scandalous about the status of drinking water in this valley. You've been listening to Down in the Valley. We'll see you next month. Thanks a million for listening.
You are listening to KFSCLP 94.1 FM in Visalia, California.
I'm Uncle Bill, the president of the South Valley Peace Center, and the first Sunday of the month is our summer schedule peace demonstration at the corner of Caldwell and Mooney in Visalia. We'll go out to breakfast after the demonstration ends at 9 o'clock. So it'll be 8 to 9 a.m. on the first Sunday of the month, Caldwell and Mooney.
Hello, my name is Rick Morris, and I'm president of the Tulare County Chapter of Americans for Safe Access. Americans for Safe Access is the nation's largest nonprofit medical marijuana advocacy organization. ASA has over 30,000 members from all walks of life. The Tulare County Chapter was established December 15, 2005. In the past 2 years, the Tulare County Chapter has worked with local law enforcement, local politicians, and local committees to help protect the rights of medical marijuana patients and caregivers. We work closely with the Tulare County Planning Commission to bring the Medical Marijuana State ID Card Program. Additionally, we worked with the Tulare County Planning Commission to overturn an indefinite ban on medical marijuana in Tulare County. The Tulare County Chapter is establishing a scholarship program to assist lower-income patients and caregivers. This program will help patients and caregivers pay for doctor's appointments and medication. The Tulare County Chapter is also establishing a transportation program to assist disabled and non-ambulatory patients and caregivers. This program will help patients and caregivers with public and private transportation to doctor visits, court dates, and to pick up medication. The Tulare County Chapter of ASA has held several public meetings at the Visalia Convention Center. These meetings provide information to the general public, and we need volunteers to help make these meetings a success. If you'd like to get involved, or if you have any questions or comments, feel free to call me, Rick Morris, president of the Tulare County Chapter of Americans for Safe Access, 559-553-2650. Or visit the ASA website at safeaccessnow.org. Thank you.
Coming up, another program that airs on KFCF 88.1 in Fresno every other Friday at 2:30 p.m. It's called Ideas on the Edge. This week's guest is Michael Mann, author of the book Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming. He is being interviewed by host Mike Beavers. For a listing of KFCF programs, go to kfcf.org.
IPCC stands for
IPCC,
the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It operates under the auspices of the United Nations, and more or less every 5 years or so, thousands of the world's scientists get together and over the course of several years put together a lengthy, sometimes technical, report summarizing our current state of knowledge with regard to the issue of climate change. And that involves both the basic underlying science, you know, how does the climate system work, what's the greenhouse effect, how are we changing the greenhouse effect, how do we know that recent warming is due to human influences, these sort of basic scientific questions. And it also deals with issues such as what are the likely impacts that we can expect if we continue on the course that we're on, the current rate of fossil fuel burning, and what can we do about it? What are the various means by which we can mitigate the problem, is the technical word used to describe basically the question, how can we solve this problem? What are the main methods by which we might, for example, reduce our reliance on fossil fuels in various sectors of the economy and across the globe? So it's a very wide-ranging set of questions and issues that are really tackled in these IPCC reports. And what we felt was important to do was to try to take this vast and sometimes technical discussion that's thousands of pages long and try to boil it down in a way that ordinary folks without technical backgrounds can basically understand the nature of the problem, what we might expect if we don't do something about the problem, and how we can go about solving the problem. So that's really what spurred us on to try to create this sort of user-friendly version of the IPCC report.
Well, it is a very beautifully illustrated, and the concepts are laid out so that I could understand them. I'm somewhat of a scientist, but I have a lot to learn on this global warming. But there are a lot of fairly clear concepts laid out here. When was the IPCC formed?
It was actually formed back in the 1980s, the late 1980s.
Was global warming an issue then?
Well, it was. It was beginning to emerge. We were beginning to, the basic science has been around for nearly two centuries. So we had even some inkling back in the early 19th century based on some early work done by scientists like Hadley and Lord Rayleigh and some of the earlier scientists whose names might be familiar to some, actually have contributed to a body of knowledge that's grown over a period of about in the past two centuries, to the point where we now have a fairly good understanding of what drives the climate system. So the science has been around for some time. The idea that we might be influencing the climate of the Earth through increasing these so-called greenhouse gases, scientists by the late 19th century and the early 20th century were already beginning to suspect that, and in fact in the early 20th century had even made some measurements to suggest that this might be underway. So over time, of course, our knowledge has progressed, the climate has continued to change, and really sometime at about roughly the mid-1980s and especially the late 1980s, where some scientists were looking at the data that was coming in, comparing it with what the theoretical calculations tell us should happen if we continue to burn fossil fuels and increase the concentration of greenhouse gases, and we're saying, well, what we're seeing now, the warming we're seeing, is consistent with what the models predict. It seems to be outside the range of what we would expect if it was only natural causes that were leading to changes in climate. And so that more or less corresponds with the time frame on which the IPCC was founded, began to issue reports, the first assessment report in 1990, the second assessment report in 1995, the third assessment report, which I was a lead author on, that came out in 2001, and now just about a year ago, today, almost to the day, the most recent fourth assessment report of the IPCC came out. And in fact, it was in part the accumulated work over these four assessments that have led to a series now of four of these very extensive reports that actually led to the IPCC being co-named along with Al Gore last year as a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
We are speaking with Michael Mann, co-author of the new book, Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming. And just as a comment on the back of the book, from Ross Gelbspan, author of The Heat Is On and Boiling Point, he said, comments on the book, with its eye-grabbing graphics and reader-friendly prose, Dire Predictions walks us through the findings of the world's leading climate scientists and places the ultimate responsibility for the human future directly at our feet. I guess with knowledge comes responsibility, unfortunately. We can't just read these things and do nothing, I guess, is the expected response here, and it's one that I'm kind of trying to grapple with. We have a lot of evidence from the current administration and other sources that they don't believe in probably a lot of what you have presented here. One of the most convincing aspects that I saw in this book was that some of these models have been validated by experience. Is that true?
Absolutely, yes. This is something that's not often well appreciated in these discussions. There, in fact, has been extensive what we call validation of these models. Various experiments have been performed, and in particular, experiments where the answer can't be known in advance because one is predicting the future. I think it was a Yogi Berraism that predictions are difficult, especially about the future, I think it's sometimes said. So that, in fact, very much applies to the issue of testing climate models. There's no more convincing experiment that you can perform than to make a prediction and to wait it out and see if the prediction turns out to have been correct, measured against what actually happened. That is difficult to do on the time frame relevant to, say, judging what the impact of continued fossil fuel burning out to the end of this century is likely to be. We can't validate projections that are a century away. We don't have time to do that. And if we waited that long, most likely it would be impossible to mitigate the changes underway. In fact, one could argue that we may not have much more than a few years to start taking decisive action in curtailing fossil fuel burning if we want to avoid breaching certain levels of future climate change that many scientists deem as constituting what we call a dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate. And so we have to act fairly quickly on the problem to avoid some of the worst consequences. And that's just the nature of the beast. The climate system consists of interacting components like the ocean and the atmosphere and the ice sheets. And these components, like the ice sheets and the oceans, have very long response time scales. The ocean contains a huge mass of water. It takes a long time to heat up that water or to cool it down. And so we can't actually test predictions, say, a century out, and we certainly wouldn't want to wait that long to determine whether or not we trust what the models are telling us. Instead, we make shorter-term predictions, and nature actually provides us some perfect opportunities to do that. In fact, James Hansen, who we profile in the book, Dr. James Hansen of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Interestingly, this is a NASA laboratory that's in uptown New York City. It's actually in the same building as Tom's Diner of Seinfeld fame. So it's always interesting to go visit colleagues there, and you're walking into the restaurant from the Seinfeld show. They have been doing experiments of this sort for some time, and back in the early 1990s, after Mount Pinatubo erupted, James Hansen predicted in advance, based on our knowledge of what a volcanic eruption does to the climate system. Essentially, it puts a lot of reflective material, what we call aerosol, up into the lower stratosphere. And the stratosphere is a fairly stable part of the atmosphere, unlike the lower atmosphere called the troposphere, which is where we live. And so if you get that stuff up into the stratosphere, it can stay there for a while, for several years. In fact, those of you in California back in the 1980s saw the effect of the Mount St. Helens eruption for several years thereafter. Some of the magnificent sunsets were due to the fact that there was still this aerosol up in the atmosphere from that eruption. So these volcanic eruptions put this aerosol up into the atmosphere. It hangs around for a few years, and while it's there, it's reflecting or absorbing incoming solar radiation that otherwise would have reached the surface of the Earth. And it's not available to reach the surface of the Earth because it's being reflected by these aerosols back out to space. that actually leads to a cooling of the surface of the Earth that's measurable and predictable. Dr. Hansen successfully predicted that the global average temperature would cool by somewhere between a half a degree and 1 degree centigrade, which is what happened. So it was an experiment, a prediction that was made. It was a test of the models to see if a prediction made would actually come true, and indeed, it passed that test. In fact, it was also Dr. Hansen who, back in the late 1980s, performed an experiment where he took his model, he looked at three possible scenarios of how we would choose to go about our fossil fuel emissions over the next few decades. So back in the 1980s, he said, well, let's look at three possible scenarios for the path that human beings choose to take over the next few decades in terms of fossil fuel burning and the elevation of greenhouse gases, and what does the model predict for each of those scenarios? Well, it turns out that one of the three scenarios matched fairly closely what we did decide to do. It matched fairly closely the emissions that we have followed in the several decades since that prediction was made. And for that scenario, which is very much like the scenario we followed, the overall increase in temperature in the model is spot on. It's almost exactly what the record shows has happened in the nearly 20 years since.
Does this represent proof? I mean, in other words, you know, the cynical naysayers, I mean, is this proof, or is there such a thing as clear-cut proof of human activity altering the climate?
No, it's a basic tenet of science that you can never prove something true. You can only disprove it. And for a hypothesis to actually constitute a legitimate scientific hypothesis, it has to be falsifiable. It has to be possible that there is an experiment that could be done that could demonstrate that the hypothesis is incorrect. And so that's how science is done. And often people who don't have a scientific background aren't aware of that sort of basic underlying aspect of scientific hypothesis making and testing. You can never prove something to be true. You can only disprove it. And so the existing theories that we have that constitute our best understanding of the way things work, like Newtonian gravity or quantum mechanics or natural selection, evolution, there's no way to prove them true, but these are theories that every time they've been tested, they've held up, and they are our best available explanation of how things work. Well, that's true in climate as well. The models that we use basically embody our understanding of the laws of physics as they govern the atmosphere and the ocean, and the exchange of heat between the atmosphere and the ocean, and the behavior of ice sheets, and how they move over time, and how they melt, or how they accumulate mass. And so all of that physics is in the models that we use. We're literally solving the equations of physics as they apply to this fairly complicated system, or the Earth's climate system. But it doesn't stop there, because the climate system isn't just a physics problem. It's also a biology problem. We have to describe the cycles of water and carbon through the ocean and the atmosphere. And those are processes that are chemical and biological in nature that influence those natural cycles. And those cycles, in turn, are going to influence the concentration of these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which, of course, has a profound impact on the surface temperatures that we experience on Earth. It's a very complicated problem, but we have models just as physicists have models or biologists have models. Climate scientists have models of how the system works, and they can test those models by making predictions. And climate models, again and again, have been shown to make correct predictions.
We're speaking with Michael Mann, co-author of Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, an illustrated guide to the findings of the IPCC.
You are listening to KFSCLP 94.1 FM in Visalia, California.
And it is very compelling, the information you have in here. One section I found interesting was when you discussed the drought in the western U.S., and you mentioned that it might be symptomatic of a longer-term global pattern. I mean, we've had pretty significant drought here. Is this something that is part of a bigger picture?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a question that climate scientists are working hard to answer. We don't have definitive answers to these questions, but we have findings that are fairly suggestive. A good example is the one that you've just raised, the issue of this fairly prolonged drought that we've now seen over a large part of the western U.S., the desert southwest in particular, but also other parts of the western U.S. There are areas in the western U.S. where the current drought is unprecedented over the admittedly fairly short time frame of about 100 years where we have reliable measurements. So there's this recent drought. It's more than a decade long in some areas. Some areas it was briefly broken by the 2005 El Nino event, but once that subsided, then the drought returned. And one question that scientists ask is this, in fact, an anomalous drought? Is this something that's unlikely to happen naturally on over a century or a longer time scale? And paleoclimate scientists use indirect measures of past climate. They look at what are called proxies, and this is discussed in the book quite a bit, tree rings and corals and ice cores and other sorts of natural archives that we have in our environment that we can look at, and often we can date them back in time with trees. Obviously, we can date the annual rings back in time. We can count back 1 year at a time. We can build up a longer-term chronology, albeit an uncertain chronology, because these are proxies. It's not like having a thermometer measurement or a rain gauge or a barometer measurement. These are what we call noisy records. They're not perfect, but they give us some idea of how the climate changed prior to the modern period, really, again, only about the past century or so, where we have widespread instrumental-based measurements of climate. And there's some suggestion in the tree ring evidence that this recent drought now might be approaching the sort of peak magnitude of drought seen in the past 1,000 years or longer.
I had heard one time that there were tree ring studies that indicated that droughts, there were pretty significant droughts in the past, and we worry about this a lot locally because of the farming economy, and we've really only been under cultivation about 100 years, in some areas 50 years, and so every time we have a real perturbation in the weather, it's not altogether clear whether this whole plan of farming is really a long-term plan that will last. And so we're, you know, locally we're quite concerned about that. But is that true about the tree rings? I mean, they had a 50-year drought back in the 16th century or something like that?
You know, that's an excellent point. In parts of the western U.S., there's fairly strong evidence that, in fact, a little bit further back than what you've described, really going back to the medieval era, the 13th and the 14th centuries, when the Anasazi society and Native American society collapsed in the Four Corners region, some of in the earlier centuries of the past millennium, there's evidence that there was indeed drought that by many measures was probably greater than anything that we've seen since. And only now, again, in maybe that past decade, there's some hint that this recent drought might actually be approaching the magnitude of this so-called mega drought that occurred many centuries ago. And there are really several lessons to learn from this. One of them is that as happened to the Anasazi, their society collapsed when they were faced with the challenges of this drought that was unprecedented to them. There was nothing in their experience to prepare them to deal with a sudden aridification, drying of the region. Well, today, we are, in fact, far more dependent on our environment in terms of the number of people that we have to provide with energy, food, and water. And in a sense, we're even more vulnerable to changes in climate because we have such a large infrastructure that in many ways is so tightly calibrated to the current climate. What that means is that if the climate begins to change, and it changes rapidly, there is a real threat to our ability to maintain our ability to grow crops, as you've alluded to, agriculture, patterns of agriculture, meeting water demand. There is one recent study that suggests that if this current drought continues into the future as the climate models actually predict it to, in fact, the models predict that the drought will get worse if we continue to raise greenhouse gas concentrations. Lake Powell will probably dry within 20 or 25 years. Of course, that's a major source of water in the western U.S. in fact, it's not so much the absolute climate. People sometimes, you'll hear people say, well, how do we know that this is the best climate? Maybe the climate that we're headed towards through fossil fuel burning is a better climate. Well, there's no such thing as a better climate or a worse climate. There's the climate that you've adapted to, and there's the climate that modern infrastructure is dependent upon. And anything that changes the climate rapidly to cause it to go away from that climate that we've adapted to is obviously a real threat. And we detail, you know, the various ways in which that's true in the book, where we talk about climate change projections and the likely impacts of those changes.
We're speaking again with Michael Mann, who is co-author with Lee Kump of the book Dire Predictions, which is an excellent compendium. We've gone into a lot of detail here in the last half hour, and there's much more detail in this book. I mean, he covers issues like geoengineering solutions to climate change. He's talking about agriculture solving global warming. He's talking about many, many aspects of this very complicated problem. And it's illustrated and expressed quite clearly. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I would like to ask many more questions. Can I ask one quick question?
Absolutely.
The IPCC...
I'll keep my answer short.
The IPCC, do they have... that's a lot of different scientists. Are there skeptics involved with that? Or, I mean, is there a range of opinion? Or is this something that is really not even debatable?
Well, in fact, many of the members of the IPCC panel, scientists who contribute to the IPCC reports, are skeptics in the best sense. Skepticism is a good thing in science. We should be skeptical. We should demand proof. Anytime an argument is made, we should examine the strengths and the weaknesses of that argument. That's what science is all about. In fact, over the years, there has been a very significant and fundamentally productive input from scientists who are skeptical, who have been rightly skeptical of various aspects of our understanding of the climate system. Now, skepticism has to be contrasted with what I call contrarianism. Contrarianism is something very different. It's just almost playing the devil's advocate for the sake of doing so, rather than based on scientific principles. And there are some, for example, who will question the science behind climate change, but they don't apply that same critical view to the arguments that they're using to criticize our current understanding.
I think I get the gist of what you're saying there, and I really wish we could continue further with Michael Mann, but I'm afraid that's going to have to be the last comment, and thank you so much. Again, the book, Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming. This is Mike Beavers. The program is Ideas on the Edge, and we are on every other Friday at 2:30. Thank you very much, Michael Mann.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And thank you, everyone. We will see you in 2 weeks.
Whenever life gets you down, things are hard and tough, people are stupid, obnoxious, and daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, well, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. It's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned, round the sun that is the source of all our power. And the sun and you and me and all the stars that you can see are moving at a million miles a day in an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour in a galaxy we call Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 million stars, 100,000 light years side to side. It borders in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us, it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions and billions in this amazing and expanding universe. The universe itself goes on expanding and expanding in every direction it can whiz. As fast as it can go, the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely was your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up above. 'cause there is bugger all down here on Earth.
On March 14th, 15th, and 16th, Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans made history at the Winter Soldier Gathering in Silver Springs, Maryland, where they spoke out about war crimes they've witnessed.
The military commanders, they held me accountable for not deploying and for trying to kill myself and being weak, basically, being emotionally and mentally broken. Major Wesner, Captain Mello, Lieutenant Colonel Adji, First Sergeant Titu, and Sergeant Major Altman, I have one message for you, and that is something that is internationally understood across the world, and that's this. Peace.
KPFA was there to bring the Winter Soldier Gathering to our listeners. By visiting warcomeshome.org, you can hear the testimonials from the broadcast, as well as see photos of the gathering and post your comments. Visit warcomeshome.org.
Mom and Dad got married and dropped out of junior high, for they were blessed with triplets, Velma, Thor, and I. Of children there came many more, and as the tribe increased, we found this humble home of ours where the love has never ceased.
Love in a refrigerator box, a shiny new refrigerator box.
Folks would say we had it rough, but we dug around and we found plenty of stuff.
Love in a refrigerator box, our very own refrigerator box.
They'd offer Dad work, but he'd decline, 'cause it would get in the way of our quality time. Our home was a refrigerator box. When we were in our troubled teens, we were tempted to break the law by boosting deposit bottles and lifting trinkets we liked and saw. But Mama walked us down to visit convicts in the jail. We saw they were not happy, even though they lived so well.
Love in a refrigerator box, harvest gold refrigerator box.
Our only toys was dirt and worms we'd find along those highway berms.
Love in a refrigerator box, 20 cubic foot refrigerator box.
Our shoes was made from blown out tires, our clothes was snatched from garbage fires. Our home was a refrigerator box. In the morning, when the sun would poke through the ashes and the smoke, our ma would disentangle us and pack us off to school. The town kids would laugh and call us box babies. We'd choke back tears and turn our other cheeks. Why knock us down, we'd say. And like inflatable clown punching bags, we'd pop right back up a smiling and go on to live normal American lives like Joan Crawford and J. Edgar Hoover. Now this old box looks tattered and much smaller than it did, but these freshly whitewashed tires and rocks dress it up like when I was a kid. We all owe everything we are to the wisdom of Mom and Dad, and the home we shared together, and the love it seems we had.
Love in a refrigerator box.
Oh, sing it, children.
Refrigerator box.
They'd never take no handouts, sooner stand out in the rain.
Love in a refrigerator box.
Was dancing on a mountain of trash, and we're singing this sweet refrain. Our home was a refrigerator box, a beautiful refrigerator box.
You are listening to KFSCLP 94.1 FM in Visalia, California.